low vision, or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 31st, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. We spent Christmas in North Carolina with 70-degree temperature, so this is going into the deep freeze of Buffalo, New York. Now for the main articles under business and finance. The U.S. stock market is closing out 2025 near an all-time high, with the S&P 500 17% gain vaulting the index toward its seventh best three-year run on record. After a year of blistering growth, artificial intelligence chip makers are preparing for a bigger 2026, but that very success has created a host of challenges for the AI ecosystem as a whole. When the Fed met to cut interest rates this month, some officials said they were reluctant to support more easing in the near future, minutes show. Government moves to ease rules around bank deals and capital requirements are emboldening activist investors to take aim at lenders they consider ripe for change. British renewable energy startup Octopus will spin off utility management platform Kraken Technologies at a valuation of $8.65 billion. Walmart experienced an outage, leaving thousands of customers unable to access its mobile app and website before service was restored. Tesla deliveries in the fourth quarter are expected to drop 15% from a year earlier, according to a compilation of estimates published by the automaker. Walt Disney settled claims over its data collection practices with children in a deal where it was ordered to pay $10 million. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. A CIA attack against a dock in Venezuela earlier this month was the first known operation inside the country since Trump authorized the agency to operate clandestinely against its drug traffickers and government. The oil tanker the Coast Guard has been pursuing for nearly 2 weeks has had a Russian flag sloppily painted on its hull in an apparent attempt to claim protection from Moscow, U.S. officials said. Tensions between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates flared in an escalating dispute spurred by fighting in Yemen. Russia said Ukrainian drones targeted one of Putin's official residences and is using its claim, denied by Ukraine, to justify a hardening of its stance in peace negotiations with Kyiv. The Trump administration said it is freezing federal child care funding to Minnesota, following allegations of fraud schemes involving the state's social services system. Iranians protested for a third day in frustration at a spiraling economic crisis. Israel said it suspended more than 24 humanitarian organizations from operating in Gaza for not complying with registration rules. Died, Tatiana Schlossberg, 35, journalist and granddaughter of John F. K. Ben Nighthorse Campbell, 92, former senator and Native American advocate. The picture on today's front page takes place on a rooftop in New York City where a gigantic crystal ball is being prepared by workers. And that caption reads, "In with the new." The constellation ball, the ninth sphere in the history of the iconic New Year's Eve ball drop in New York City, measures 12.5 feet in diameter and weighs 12,350 pounds with 5,280 Waterford crystals in circular shapes and LED light pucks. In that headline, Times Square set to have a ball on New Year's Eve. From the front page, stocks defy tariff jitters in 25. Trump's policies didn't raise prices as much as feared, with AI powering growth. By David Uberti. The U.S. stock market is closing out 2025 near an all-time high, with the S&P 500's 17% gain vaulting the index toward its seventh best three-year run on record. The year's long rally appeared to end abruptly in the spring with the rollout of President Trump's Liberation Day tariffs and the emergence of Sell America, trades that bet on the U.S.'s retreat from the world stage, only to roar back to life within weeks. The slowdown foreseen by many on Wall Street never materialized in full. Tariff exemptions and a slew of trade deals limited the inflationary effects of the highest import taxes in decades. And an artificial intelligence arms race triggered a capital spending boom of epic proportions, propelling growth, minting millionaires, and leaving the U.S. stock market even more top-heavy than before. NVIDIA's 40% climb this year lags behind Broadcom's 51% advance and farther still from Alphabet's 66% rally. But those gains look pedestrian next to Advanced Micro Devices' 78% run-up. Palantir skyrocketed 139%. Micron Technology posted a 248% increase. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 14% this year, while the NASDAQ Composite gained 21%. On Tuesday, the S&P 500 inched 0.1% lower, and the NASDAQ ticked down 0.2%. The Dow fell 0.2%, or 95 points. Even as China's export machine grew in the face of Trump's trade policies, pressuring economies around the world, much of Wall Street still views U.S. tech companies as preeminent. Broadcom plus the Magnificent Seven, which includes Amazon, Meta, Tesla, Apple, Microsoft, account for 40% of the S&P 500's market cap, according to Dow Jones market data. That is more than double the 15% commanded by the index's eight biggest names a decade ago. Betting against them is a dangerous game, said Thorne Perkin, president of Papa Marcu Wellner Perkin. That concentration at times brought more turbulence to the market this year, be it from April's tariff announcements, Chinese AI advances, or construction delays at data center projects. In November, an information vacuum during the government shutdown and scrutiny of AI returns sent markets into a tailspin. But with each setback, Wall Street traders and individual investors stepped up to buy the dip. The S&P 500 is up 38% from its lowest close in April. Surprisingly resilient consumer spending shored up an uncertain economic backdrop. AI chip makers ready for big gains next year. NVIDIA leads pack but faces increasing competition, supply chain challenges. By Robbie Wayland and Sebastian Herrera. Driven by the explosive growth of artificial intelligence, the largest semiconductor companies in the world recorded more than $400 billion in combined sales in 2025, by far the biggest year for chips on record. Next year promises to be even bigger. Yet the blistering pace of growth, fed by what CEOs and analysts describe as insatiable demand for computing power, has created a host of challenges, from shortages of vital components to questions about how and when AI companies will be able to generate reliable enough profits to keep buying chips. Hardware designers such as NVIDIA, which more than doubled its revenue year over year, are the main suppliers of the picks and shovels behind the new digital gold rush. But NVIDIA faces growing competition from the likes of Alphabet's Google and Amazon.com, while the battleground shifts under its feet. Last week, NVIDIA signed a $20 billion licensing deal with the chip startup Groq, which design chips and software that help accelerate AI inference, the process whereby trained AI models serve up answers to prompts. Where the last leg of the AI race was defined by training, tech giants are now competing to deliver the fastest and most cost-efficient inference. Inference workloads are more diversified and may open up new areas for competition, analyst at Bernstein wrote after NVIDIA's recent deal was announced. Data center operators, AI labs, and business customers have clamored for NVIDIA's advanced H200 and B200 graphics processing units. Google's increasingly sophisticated custom chips, known as TPUs, and Amazon's Trainium and inferential chips, both of which compete with NVIDIA's GPUs, are also scooping up customers, while software developers such as OpenAI are joining with custom designers such as Broadcom to design their own chips. Flu cases jump sharply. The flu has sickened an estimated 7.5 million people so far this season, outpacing last year's spread of the disease. The sharp rise in cases has heightened fears of a new strain. About 81,000 people have been hospitalized, and 3,100 have died so far this flu season, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated, including 8 children. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Maduro under pressure. Don't worry, be happy. By Kejal Vyas. President Trump says Nicolas Maduro is running out of time. But as U.S. warships amass off Venezuela's coast and Washington escalates a partial oil blockade, the embattled strongman is signaling something very different, that he expects to outlast U.S. pressure. In recent weeks, the 63-year-old leftist has been dancing on stage at rallies, strolling trade expos, and attending Christmas tree lightings hand in hand with his wife. He has serenaded supporters with dance remixes and offered up his own rendition of John Lennon's Imagine, all as Trump administration officials call for him to exit into exile or suffer the consequences. "Don't worry, be happy," Maduro said at an event in the capital of Caracas, wearing a sombrero and flashing a peace sign as he sang along to Bobby McFerrin classic. The choreographed appearances are Maduro's way of projecting confidence and showing he has little intention of backing down amid the most sustained challenge to his leadership more than 13 years in power. The U.S. has used a massive military buildup in the Caribbean to carry out deadly strikes on alleged drug-running boats and launched a partial blockade on Venezuela's oil exports, a source of revenue Maduro uses to keep his regime together. On Monday, Trump said the U.S. attacked a dock where drugs were loaded, though we didn't offer details and Venezuela didn't confirm the attack. Maduro and his inner circle are reluctant to cede power, partly because of the U.S. criminal indictments and international sanctions they face out of office. Maduro withstood Trump's efforts to oust him through a so-called maximum pressure campaign in 2019. "They'll never be able to remove us from the path to revolution," Maduro recently told supporters. "Victory forever." Beneath Maduro's gambit is the ideological self-importance he feels as the standard bearer for his mentor, Hugo Chavez, the leftist strongman who tilted Venezuela into socialism and against the U.S. during the 14 years of rule before his 2013 death. Maduro, who calls himself the son of Chavez, said he is committed to prolonging his socialist revolution at the cost of his own life and is carrying the left's fight in the region, creating a direct link to late icons like Chile's Salvador Allende, Fidel Castro in Cuba, and Latin American liberator Simón Bolívar. Deals involving amnesty in exchange for his abdication of the presidency, as the U.S. has presented in the past, don't appeal to him, said people who have met with Maduro and other high-ranking officials. The U.S. military buildup and threats, they said, seem like a big bluff to Maduro. The wildest ride at Epcot, keeping day drinkers upright. A popular drinking challenge shows how quickly things can go from magical to messy. By Connor Hart. Rusty Featherstone and Willie Donnellan began their most recent trip to Epcot with Palomas in Mexico. They chased the cocktails with two Norwegian beers, then moved on to China for some hibiscus iced teas. At that point, the duo was still in the early innings of the Drinking Around the World Challenge, a worrisome fact for a theme park built around families and fairy tales. More than 8 drinks later, with the challenge complete, both Featherstone and Donnellan were hammered. I could walk out of there on my own 2 feet, but I was like, I need to go lay down, Donnellan, a 25-year-old content creator, said. Drinking around the world, a fan-made challenge that entails ordering a drink from each of the 11 countries in Epcot's World Showcase, has existed for decades. But a recent surge of social media attention has pushed the tradition into the spotlight. It has also highlighted the thin line between magical and messy at the Disney park. New evidence shows that bans on phones in classrooms work. By Julie Jargon. Some districts see higher test scores, less disruptive behavior, and kids going back to being kids. A large urban district in Florida saw an increase in student test scores. A smaller school district in rural California is experiencing a dramatic decline in student behavioral problems. The reason for both? The absence of smartphones in the classroom. Early data on the effects of school phone bans confirm what teachers and administrators have long suspected, that phones in the classroom were the primary culprit behind bad behavior and low engagement. When you have 267 incidents of threats and physical injury in the first 10 weeks of a school year, that's a serious problem, said April Moore, superintendent of the Sierra Sands Unified School District near California's Mojave Desert. Of last year's disciplinary problems, students were using their phones to plan bathroom vaping meetups, gossip sessions, and fights. When behaviors escalate in an invisible space, we can't prevent them or react as fast, said Moore, who presides over a district of about 5,000 students. Since a district-wide ban on cell phone use during instructional class time went into effect this fall, student behavior has turned around. Incidents involving threats and physical injury in the first 10 weeks this school year declined by almost half to 142. The number of disciplinary actions for harassment dropped by nearly 83% to 19. Total suspensions were down 69% to 72. Moore said the district won't have data on how the ban has affected academic performance until first semester grades are tallied in January. It might seem like a no-duh moment, but the effort to get phones out of the classroom wasn't easy and continues to be a challenge for many school districts. OpenAI's pay tops that of any recent tech startup. By Burbergen, Nate Ratner, and Bradley Olson. OpenAI is paying employees more than any tech startup in recent history, according to financial data it has shown investors. The company's stock-based compensation is about $1.5 million an employee on average across its workforce of roughly 4,000. That is more than 7 times higher than the stock-based pay Alphabet's Google disclosed in 2003, before it filed for an initial public offering in 2004. The $1.5 million is about 34 times the average employee compensation of 18 other large tech companies in the year before they went public, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of data compiled by Equilor. The analysis reviewed major tech IPOs over the last 25 years. Russia insists Ukraine targeted Putin residence. No visual evidence of an attack on Novgorod has been published. By Thomas Grove and Georgi Kanchev. It is known as Dogier Borody or Longbeards, and it is one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's favored official residences, built on a lake shore in the country's northwest. In the past, it was used by Soviet leaders Joseph Stalin and Nikita Khrushchev. The Kremlin has alleged that Ukrainian drones targeted the well-protected site of Novgorod and is using its claim to justify a hardening of its stance in peace negotiations. The Kremlin on Tuesday declined to provide any evidence to back up its assertions. Ukrainian officials from President Volodymyr Zelensky on down have vociferously denied undertaking any such attack. That hasn't stopped Putin from trying to use the accusations to sour relations between Washington and Kyiv as it looks to weaken Ukraine's negotiating hand. Russia said it intercepted 91 drones aimed at Novgorod residents, which is ringed by sophisticated air defense systems, according to satellite images reviewed for a 2024 report by the Institute for the Study of War. President Trump was very angry after Putin leveled his allegation in a phone call Monday. Asked if the U.S. had evidence such an attack had taken place, Trump replied, "You're saying maybe the attack didn't take place? That's possible too, I guess. But President Putin told me this morning it did." Officials in Moscow have seized on it as a warrant to increase its punishment of Kyiv and target government buildings. Russia also says it is a reason to recalibrate its negotiating points with Trump. So far, Russia has made no concessions or softened its demands during months of talks toward ending the war, plans for which have become increasingly unacceptable to the Kremlin. No visual evidence of an attack on Novgorod has been published, nor have any independent intelligence assessments been made public to confirm the veracity of Russia's allegation. Granddaughter of JFK wrote of leukemia fight, by Jack Morfitt. Tatiana Schlossberg, an environmental journalist and granddaughter of President John F. Kennedy, has died, her family said Tuesday. She was 35 years old. "Our beautiful Tatiana passed away this morning," the family said. "She will always be in our hearts." Schlossberg, daughter of Caroline Kennedy and Edwin Schlossberg, revealed her acute myeloid leukemia diagnosis in a New Yorker essay in November. Doctors at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York first noticed Schlossberg's irregular white blood cell count hours after she gave birth to her second child in May 2024, according to the essay. "I had a son whom I loved more than anything and a newborn I needed to take care of," she wrote. "This could not possibly be my life." Schlossberg was treated at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York, where her cancer alternated between remission and relapse after several bone marrow transplants and clinical trials, she said. She watched from her hospital bed as her mother's cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was confirmed as U.S. Health Secretary. Schlossberg said she worried she would spend her life immunocompromised if Kennedy, whom she called an embarrassment to the family, banned vaccines she required after cancer treatment. Schlossberg studied at Yale University and the University of Oxford in England before coming a climate change and environmental journalist. She married George Moran in 2017, with whom she shared her son and daughter. After hearing from a doctor that she had roughly a year to live, Schlossberg said she feared her children wouldn't remember her. "But I try to live and be with them now," she wrote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of 2025. Terrorists are weaker and the border is secure. The chaos and conspiracy theories are spreading. By Carl Rove. If you listed the worst years in American history, 2025 wouldn't be near the top. Our economy is growing better than most of the world. Total non-farm employment is up slightly year over year. Inflation is under 3%. The southern border is secured. U.S. murders are on a pace for the biggest yearly drop on record. America isn't involved in any major wars. The war in Gaza has ground to a halt. Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Iranian-backed terror groups are significantly weakened. The U.S. and Israel destroyed key Iranian nuclear facilities. And even though America dithered over critical aid, beleaguered Ukraine hangs on as Russia's invasion approaches its fourth anniversary. This year had its share of bizarre developments. No American president has ever ruled the news cycle like Donald Trump. He's omnipresent, completely dominating coverage, constantly in front of cameras, and inundating us with round-the-clock Truth Social posts. His pace is unrelenting. He throws at reporters so much fluff, personal asides, fumigations about adversaries real and imagined, commentary on culture, and self-congratulation that the press and public often ignore important things. This pace is also unsustainable. There are signs that the public is tiring of his hyperbole and insatiable desire for retribution. Increasingly, they may hear only the offensive or cruel things he says. Has the president convinced himself that he doesn't need to sell his policies and actions? It appears that he believes he can will people into agreeing with him by claiming his achievements are the biggest, best, and most amazing in American history. He's gone way too far by slapping his name on buildings. The Donald J. Trump and the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts, and government programs, the Navy's Trump-class battleship. He might receive a fawning reaction from his MAGA base, but the average American finds such narcissism off-putting. Americans would be much more likely to support Mr. Trump if he explained what he's doing and asked for patience as his administration makes necessary changes. But that isn't his way. Presidents do best when they under-promise and over-deliver. The opposite, over-promising and under-delivering, angers voters. They often take out their anger at the ballot box. This year, Americans were also increasingly fascinated by conspiracy theories. Take Jeffrey Epstein. It isn't enough that he committed heinous sex crimes and then took his life before being tried. Many people feel the need to place him at the center of a worldwide conspiracy of wealthy, powerful people. These co-conspirators murdered him in jail, it said, because of the threat he posed to them. Mr. Trump's failure to deliver the goods on this fast plot has undermined his followers' confidence in his Justice Department and Federal Bureau of Investigation. Health-related conspiracies abound. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. claims that drug companies are promoting vaccinations that cause autism. He has also said that the COVID-19 shot is the deadliest vaccine ever made. It gets darker. Prominent MAGA voices are reverting to anti-Semitic tropes, asserting that Israel and Jews in general are running America's foreign policy. It gets weirder. One podcaster claims that French President Emmanuel Macron's wife is a man. Many voters rightly see all this as deranged. Other happenings signal that significant changes may be on the horizon. MAGA is engaged in internecine, mutually destructive warfare with different people who claim to represent and lead the movement, viciously attacking one another. Populist and traditional conservatives are increasingly at odds over important policy issues. The Democratic Party has its own internal battles, pitting socialists against moderates and liberals. These divisions are likely to intensify as 2028 approaches. The media, meanwhile, is changing in ways that seemed unimaginable a few years ago. Some in the legacy media are attempting to reestablish public trust. Barry Weiss at CBS is insisting the network return to calling balls and strikes. The Washington Post is trying to move toward the center. Only time will tell if these experiments pan out. The prevailing theme is the public's pervasive distrust of virtually every institution in American life. There's almost no authority figure or august body in our society in which most people have confidence. That's dangerous for the country. In many ways, our nation's public life seems overwhelming. Mutual contempt defines much of our politics. We're confused and exhausted. We have to get our act together. How the coming year plays out will have enormous, long-lasting consequences. We all have work to do, rebuilding trust and restoring civility. Because we're Americans, I'm betting we'll get it done. We always have. Happy New Year. Now get to it. Mr. Rove was senior advisor and deputy chief of staff for President George W. Bush and is author of The Triumph of William McKinley. A slightly better you in the new year. Your resolutions can become a reality if you set your sights realistically, even embarrassingly low. By Roland Fryer. New Year's resolutions may be the most widespread behavioral experiment ever attempted, a great unsupervised trial in overconfidence. Every January, millions of us make bold predictions without data, adopt strategies without feedback, and sign up for gym memberships that quietly auto-draft until we notice the charge sometime around the 4th of July. I'm no exception. Last year, I resolved to swim in the ocean off Boston every month. That lasted until March, when the water was so cold my face went numb and I started swallowing seawater because I couldn't tell my mouth was open. At that moment, the version of me that made the resolution and the version that had to carry it out officially filed for divorce. The data are clear. Most resolutions fail. Why? What does that failure reveal about human behavior? And I can't resist, is there an optimal New Year's resolution? The good news is that social science has answers. The bad news is they aren't the answers anyone wants to hear. But if you're willing to treat self-improvement the way you'd treat an investment, anchored in evidence, calibrated to incentives, and adjusted for cognitive quirks, you can dramatically increase your odds of success. Start with the most basic economic insight about New Year's resolutions. We are awful forecasters of our future behavior. In one of my favorite papers in behavioral economics, Stefana Della Vigna and Eureka Melmendier looked at gym memberships and found that many people chose expensive monthly contracts rather than paying per visit, then exercised so little that the pay-as-you-go option would have been much cheaper. Why? Because when we sign the contract, we're forecasting future willpower. We picture an idealized version of ourselves, disciplined, virtuous, rising at dawn, rather than the empirical version that hits the snooze button. A New Year's resolution is essentially a contract your present self signs and your future self treats as a non-binding suggestion. The technical term for this is failure waiting to happen. A related problem is time inconsistency, what behavioral economists call present bias. On January 1st, the long-term payoff of a habit feels enormous. By January 17th, also known as Ditch New Year's Resolution Day, the short-term cost of going to the gym, skipping dessert, or taking a polar plunge feels even larger. If a company behaved this way, we'd call it a governance problem. When people do it, we call it January. A third line of research centers on the fresh start effect. Economist Hung Chen Dai and colleagues show that people are more likely to launch new goals after salient dates, birthdays, Mondays, the start of a semester, and of course, January 1st. But while fresh starts boost motivation to begin a goal, there's no evidence these bursts lead to durable changes in behavior. They're the motivational equivalent of a fiscal stimulus that raises confidence but never moves real gross domestic product. Buoyed by that fresh start optimism, we make big, audacious plans. They would work if intentions translated directly into actions. But decades of research show a stubborn intention behavior gap. Meta-analysis find that our stated intentions explain only about 25% to 35% of what we actually do. This raises an important question. If traditional resolutions are plagued by bad forecasting, time inconsistency, and the intention behavior gap, what actually works? The best causal evidence comes from a randomized controlled trial by Martin Oskarson, per Carlbrig and colleagues. They recruited more than 1,000 people, randomly assigned different types of resolutions, and tracked them for a full year. The main finding is refreshingly simple. People with approach-oriented goals were 26% more successful than those with avoidance goals. Exercise 3 times a week outperforms stop eating junk. Read 20 minutes a night beats reduce screen time. Avoidance goals require constant vigilance and a battle of will, while approach goals build momentum and over time reshape identity. If approach beats avoidance, the next design principle is more counterintuitive. Make the goal small, almost embarrassingly so. Research on habit formation shows that behaviors with the highest survival rate are the ones easy enough to complete on your worst days. In tiny habit experiments, trivial actions prove far more durable than grand ambitions launched with January zeal. Consistency beats intensity. But consistency depends on design. Small environmental tweaks, what Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein call choice architecture, change the cost structure of daily decisions. Want to eat healthier? Put the snacks in the basement. Want to read more? Leave a book on the nightstand and the phone in the kitchen. Want to save more? Automate the transfer and remove the choice altogether. In behavioral economics, friction is destiny. And because momentum comes from visible wins, evidence favors goals that deliver quick, unambiguous feedback, steps counted, pages written, a workout logged. Finally, the research suggests we should think less like prophets and more like engineers. Instead of declaring a single sweeping resolution, run small experiments. Try modest changes for 30 days and keep only the ones that survive contact with real life. Write resolutions for the person you actually are, not the idealized version of yourself that appears on New Year's Eve. The resolutions that endure acknowledge fatigue, distraction, and constraints. Designing for that person isn't an admission of defeat. It's a commitment to reality. The optimal New Year's resolution works with human nature rather than trying to defy it. Respecting the limits of motivation and leveraging the power of behavioral economics. My own resolution this year is to follow the social science evidence on resolutions. For me, that means 20 minutes on the Peloton every morning before I'm allowed near the coffee pot. Not a heroic streak, not a reinvention, just a system I can execute. If 20 minutes turns into 60, great. If it stays 20, I still did what I said I'd do. And if next December I discover I've actually kept a resolution all year long, I'll have done something only a few economists have ever managed, made a forecast that came true. Mr. Fryer, a journal contributor, is a professor of economics at Harvard, a founder of Equal Opportunity Ventures, and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The minimum wage makes the affordability crisis worse. Higher labor costs push prices up, while fewer jobs and hours mean less money in workers' pockets. By Jason L. Riley. Increasing the cost of hiring an employee is an odd way of addressing the supposed affordability crisis. Yet some of the same people complaining about consumer prices are also celebrating the minimum wage hikes set to take effect on January 1st. The National Employment Law Project, a left-wing advocacy group, reports that 19 states and 49 cities and counties will mark the new year by implementing a higher wage floor for workers. Later, in 2026, four more states and 22 local jurisdictions will follow suit. As affordability challenges grow, the report says, NELP supports 2026 wage increases that move us toward a good jobs economy rooted in living wages for all. Advocates contend that minimum wage hikes increase incomes and reduce poverty, but that depends. The government can force an employer to pay a minimum hourly rate, but it can't force the employer to hire someone in the first place or to guarantee current employees a certain number of hours. Minimum wage workers who keep their jobs and who retain the same number of hours benefit from an elevated minimum wage. But some employees will be let go, others will see their hours trimmed, and still others will never be hired because they've become too expensive to employ. These are only some of the trade-offs involved in increasing the minimum wage. This is a bad way to deal with affordability concerns, says American Enterprise Institute economist Michael Strain. Businesses have to absorb higher labor costs in some way, and one way is by raising consumer prices. Another way is by reducing the number of people they employ. And things become a lot less affordable when you lose your paycheck. In a forthcoming academic paper, Mr. Strain and Jeffrey Clemens analyzed changes to the minimum wage in the decade preceding the COVID pandemic. They conclude that large increases harmed employment prospects for people with limited skills and work history. The same group who have experienced the most erosion in purchasing power since the pandemic. The authors estimate that relatively large increases in minimum wages reduced employment rates among individuals with low levels of experience and education by just over 2.5 percentage points. Between 2011 and 2019, California, New York State, and the District of Columbia lifted their wage floors by 50%, 53%, and 61% respectively. New York City's minimum wage more than doubled between 2013 and 2020 and will rise to $17 an hour next year, 13% higher than in 2023. The biggest jump in 2026 will occur in Hawaii, where the minimum will rise by $2 to $16 an hour, a 14% increase. Nor is the trend limited to blue states. Republican-controlled Florida, Nebraska, and Missouri are slated for significant increases in the coming year, another sign of the economic populism that has increasingly characterized GOP policymaking in the Trump era. Nevertheless, in red and blue America alike, the lowest paid workers tend to spend a larger share of their income on food, housing, medical care, and other necessities, which makes them far more sensitive to price increases. Minimum wage mandates can make their situation even more precarious. The minimum wage for fast food workers rose to $20 an hour in California in 2024. The Journal reported that, in anticipation of the increase, restaurants halted hiring and scaled back hours. Teenage unemployment in the Golden State was already about twice the national average. Increasing the price of labor hasn't helped. Minimum wage hikes aren't effective as an anti-poverty tool either. The most reliable route out of poverty is finding a job, any job, and keeping it. Workers aren't paid the entry-level rate for very long. As productivity and experience increase, so do wages. What characterizes poor households isn't that people earn the minimum wage, it's that nobody works. To the extent that minimum wage mandates hamper hiring, they don't alleviate poverty. Americans are rightly upset about the sustained price pinch for food, energy, housing, autos, and other goods since the pandemic. Polling shows that an overwhelming percentage of voters think the economy is in bad shape. President Trump campaigned on solving the problem and still blames Joe Biden, but polls show that voters now blame Mr. Trump. Democrats capitalized on economic anxiety in this year's off-year elections. The White House and Republicans in Congress will need to find a way to keep their opponents from doing the same thing in next year's midterm contest. Making it harder for people to find employment won't help their cause. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows two women standing outside what appears to be a gingerbread decorated house. And the caption, "It's got great curb appeal, but the interior needs staging." Some New Year's sayings from famous people. Albert Einstein: learn from yesterday, live for today, and hope for tomorrow. C.S. Lewis: you are never too old to set another goal or to dream a new dream. Charlie Brown: you know how I always dread the whole year? Well, this time, I'm only going to dread one day at a time. Buddha: no matter how hard the past, you can always begin again. Ralph Waldo Emerson: write it on your heart that every day is the best day in the year. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 31st, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal, and we read the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening. Happy 2026.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Buffalo Criterion, followed at 8 o'clock by the New York Times, and at 9 o'clock by Buffalo Spree. Stay with us for these readings and more throughout the day. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,